Do you ever look at your kids and think, they've got it easy? Life was so much harder back in my day. Well, have I got the podcast for you. It's called Wait, They Did What? We take a trip back in time to when kids could buy fireworks, cars didn't have seatbelts, and we all had to sing God Save the Queen.
They did what?
They did what?
They did what?
I can't believe that.
Check it out with your kids. Wait, They Did What? Is on ABC Listen and ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever had a job that was totally unexpected? Not something you could have predicted yourself doing in a million years? Simon Blue Robinson certainly has. Blue spent a year as personal assistant and private secretary to the legendary ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev. Before that, Blue had played rugby, surfed a lot, and sailed yachts in the Caribbean. By his own account, he knew absolutely nothing about dance. And then he found himself working for Nureyev, celebrated as the greatest male ballet dancer of the 20th century. Nureyev had defected from the USSR in 1961, slipping away from his KGB minders in Paris during the height of the Cold War. The drama of his personal story, along with his phenomenal talent, made Rudolf Nureyev an international sensation. His career included dancing with the Royal Ballet in London and directing the Paris Opera Ballet. But by the time Blue met him, Nureyev was carrying a secret, was one that would ultimately claim his life. Hi, Blue.
Hi, Sarah.
Let's begin very far from the glamorous world of international dance, the Isle of Jersey, where you grew up. What sort of place was it when you were a kid?
Jersey is a wonderful place. It's a very small island, probably about 116, 117 square kilometres. And it's in the bay near Normandy, very close to France. So people will know of Mont-Saint-Michel, Saint-Malo. It's, you know, 10 or 12 miles from France, a long way from England. So it is an island, you know, way, way south of the English Channel. It's got a very large west-facing beach and small sandy beaches around it with some cliffs on top. There's no heavy industry on Jersey, so the atmosphere is very clean, the sea is relatively warm, and the surf can be pretty big. So it's a great place to grow up as a young surfer.
How did you spend your time as a boy?
I mean, outdoors was everything. And the ocean, because the island is so small and it's quite packed, there's 110,000 people on it. So it's quite busy. So if you want some peace and quiet and fun, you go offshore. You go in a kayak or you surf or you sail. And I learned to sail at school. Then I joined a cadet force and it was pleasure. It was great fun.
And what was the usual career trajectory for boys like you on Jersey?
Most of my friends, most of my mates went into finance because Jersey was occupied in the Second World War. And after the war, it was kind of desolate and it had to do something to pick up itself. So it adjusted tax, set tax laws at a low rate. That allowed people to go in and invest in the island, and there was a lot of banking there. So finance was the route, which I thought about for a while, but it wasn't going to be a good fit.
Did your parents give you any advice about whether they thought you should stay or leave the island?
My father is a Scotsman, and he travelled a lot before he came to Jersey and met Mum. And he sat myself and my brother down and said, you know, Jersey's beautiful, it's very safe, it's a great place to be, but you must travel. You must go and have a look. You have an escape plan and come back with some funds, but please, please, you know, spread your wings a bit. It's like living in a village. You either stay or you go.
So while a lot of the friends around you, Blue, were making their way in finance, you began your professional life in childcare. How did you get interested in that?
I did. I left school at 16, went into a shipyard. You know, school wasn't for me. I wanted to use my hands. I wanted to be around boats. And then a friend made sure that I got a job in a TV company, a cable TV company, just when cable TV was emerging. And so I was part of that planning operation there, and it wasn't a fit. So I went to Kathmandu with a great friend and was really confronted by poverty and dark, you know, child mutilation I saw and heard of. We were going through the back streets of Kathmandu and staying in, you know, houses and shelters and what have you, and that adjusted the way I thought. I was going to go back to a very wealthy, very organized island, and I didn't feel comfortable doing that. So I applied for a job in childcare, and that then led to a job in London in a girls' residential school as a team leader there.
And what was that atmosphere like at a girls' residential school in London?
It was hectic. There were a lot of fights. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of riots. When the girls had been abused, and they were troubled, they'd been rejected, and they were angry with the world. And I had some amazing colleagues. And there was a school on the grounds, and we ran the residential side, and it was about order. It was about getting a routine into their lives. It was getting food into their lives, nutrition. And sometimes it worked. Quite often it was just chaos, but you just kept going.
So how did your time there come to an end, Luke?
I was in a normal meeting with a colleague and one of the girls, and the girl just got up and fractured my colleague's jaw, fractured her skull, in fact, with a punch, a single punch. And that was really confronting right next to me. So I had meetings with my boss, and he said, look, you've been here a while. Maybe you need a break. 18 months is a long time in this unit. And right then, a friend of mine had said, do you want to guest on a yacht that I'm sailing across the Atlantic?
I need friends like yours, Blue.
Stick around. Yeah, I'll introduce you. And, of course, I thought, am I going to do this? Am I going to do this career? And everybody around me said, you're not staying. You need to get on this yacht. This is really you. That's a go. Go on a sabbatical.
So tell me about the life on these yachts. I mean, were these sort of pleasure yachts for holidaymakers, or were they racing yachts? What was that whole world that you were a part of?
The first part was a friend had his own yacht, quite a small one, I think 28 feet, 29 feet long, and he wanted to go to the Caribbean. It was a dream of his, so friends of his helped him get over there, and then he sailed back. But I stayed and very quickly realized that boats 60, 70, 80 feet long need crew. They need strong, reliable crew. So I was offered a job on a 60-footer and then very quickly offered a job as mate on a maxi yacht. And they are hard beasts to work.
What does the job of mate entail?
You look after the deck, and our maxi yacht was a charter yacht as well. Guests would charter it to race it. So you run the deck, you control the manoeuvres, the skipper helms and oversees everything, but you're in charge of coordinating manoeuvres and that sort of whole choreography on deck. And it's, you know, it can be dangerous. You've got huge sails the size of tennis courts. You've got huge ropes called sheets or halyards. And don't forget you're racing at night as well. You know, if they get caught in the wrong way, it can be chaos.
So this young man working on yachts in the Caribbean and other parts of the Great Ocean, how on earth did you cross paths with Rudolf Nureyev?
The yacht that I'd worked on, Ocean Leopard, we were in Saint Bartholomew in the Caribbean, and we'd all converged there because of the route de Rose, let's call it. It was a fun race sponsored by vineyards in France to help promote rosé, like the Bordeaux run, the Beaujolais run, should I say. So it was kind of a fun thing, and we were at a restaurant with all the guests and all the crew on this huge table, or two tables, and there was one other person in the restaurant the night before the race sitting on his own, this really strangely dressed person. We were all in polo shirts and shorts. It was a warm evening in the Caribbean, December night, and this individual was dressed in a long shawl. He had thick, heavy trousers on, and he had a green beret. But he had this face that was really arresting. And one of the guests, or the vineyard owners from France, said, oh, that's Nureyev. And so I thought, well, let's get him on board. Let's invite him as part of the race tomorrow.
And he said yes?
He said, yeah, I went over and he was really nervous. So I walked over in the restaurant. And there's a rule on yachts that you don't bug guests or nearby VIPs. I broke that rule, but I thought, let's get him on board. He could be a future charter guest, so let's get him on. And as I walked towards him, I could see his hand cover his wine glass. And that's what I realized later, that was when he was really nervous. And I sat down next to him. He couldn't hear me. And I invited him on board. He said, yes, sure, we'll see you tomorrow.
So what was that first experience of sailing with Nureyev, I guess, taking care of him in some sense? What was that like?
It was great. You know, the guests were interested in him. He loved the boat. We raced around the island in a sort of a fun race, and it's the first time he'd seen his waterfront house from the sea, so he was delighted. And I honestly thought he would maybe charter the yacht the following year or what have you. So the skipper was happy. We were all happy. And I had to make sure that people were safe. As you know, the sails flap around a lot when we're tacking and manoeuvring. So I sat him in the middle, below the boom, safely, and he loved the day.
So that might have been the end of the story. Maybe
sure.
You've got a client for your
sure.
for your yacht in future years.
Absolutely, so yeah.
What happened for that not to be the end of the story?
I helped him get off the boat, and he was really happy. And he said, I'd like to buy you dinner to thank you, which was fine. I went back to the boat, got cleaned up, and then picked him up and then took him to the restaurant. And we chatted, and I thought, this is the last time I'll ever see him. So I asked quite a lot of questions about ballet and about Russia and about defection. And he asked me a lot of questions about me, which was really interesting, because I didn't think I was interesting. I mean, I led this normal, loving upbringing on an island with brothers and sisters and parents who cared. And he said, oh, I had nothing like that. I had none of that. Mm. So there were two extreme worlds at that table.
Nureyev was gay and you're a handsome young man in your 20s. Did you sense that he was interested in you romantically?
Not at all. I mean, I was anyone who races on big boats is physically very strong. So I was very strong, very fit, very tanned and very blonde. And after the dinner, I dropped him home and said, thank you very much indeed for that dinner. It was wonderful. And he put his tongue in my ear.
He put his tongue in your ear.
That's yeah.
a smooth move. How did you
yeah.
respond?
The left one. and it was such a surprise, Sarah. I was shocked. And I thought, yeah, okay, here we go. Now, as I said, I was very strong. I said, no. He was very nonchalant. I'm sure he'd been rejected plenty of times by young men. And then he said, would you like to come for breakfast tomorrow? We had a day off after that race. And I said, okay, but no tongues in the ears, please.
And were you cautious around
yes,
that
sure.
side of his?
I was.
What sort of relationship he might be wanting from you?
Yes, but when you race big boats across oceans, you develop a level of self-confidence. And I was a confident guy. So I turned up for breakfast the next morning, and the place was a mess. Hey, it was a beautiful three-bedroomed villa right on the ocean, but there was sand everywhere, there was dust everywhere, there was dishes in the sink. And I said, Rudolph, where is everybody? And he said, you know, who? Well, where's the maid or the dresser or the driver? He said, I have nobody. Oh, okay, that's a bit odd. If he's famous, where's the entourage? At least have a driver. At least have somebody to come in and tidy. But he said, I've just finished in Paris Opera, running Paris Opera, and I'm working in America, and my contract says that I have an assistant. Would you like to do it?
He offered you a job right away.
It was like that.
Did you think it was a real offer?
No. Because whenever you're working on big boats or yachts or charter yachts, guests always say, next time you're in, we're at Manhattan, pop around, you smile and you say yes, but you never take it up. They're not serious. And that had happened before, and this was just another occasion. And then he dropped the idea so quickly, I thought it was just the same.
So after that breakfast, when did you next hear from him?
Then we took Leopard back to Antigua, and there was a fax from, I think, his agent saying, where are you?
Really?
And I say, well, I'm here. And I got the phone, they gave me the phone number for Rudolf, so I called him in Manhattan. He said, where are you? You should be here. I was expecting you. I said, Rudolf, you were serious? He said, of course. And I learned that everything that he said, he meant. And he said, when can you get here? I said, Rudolf, I've got a job. It doesn't work like that. And, well, it did for him. And the complicating factor was that two friends had just turned up on a yacht and they needed some help to deliver it across the Pacific. Now, that was a really special, rare trip. And that was going to be very slow, and we'd do Panama, Galapagos, Fiji, Tuamotu's my cases. So I said to Rudolf, and I've been offered this trip across the Pacific. And he said, how long does that take? Rudolf, nobody knows. It could be 6 months. Okay, see you in 6 months. Bye. Put the phone down.
Did you decide at that moment that that's where you would head after this trip across the Pacific?
I kind of thought, well, that's an option. And then as we did the trip, we went through Panama Canal, you know, through Galapagos, and I was faxing his American agent, fax back then, of course, trying to get more information. Nothing happened. And then I faxed his European agent, Luigi, and a fax came straight back. He realized that if there was somebody who wanted a position to help Rudolf as an assistant, that was gold. Rudolf needed that. And a lot of people around me said, don't take this job. Do not take this job. This guy's, you know, very quickly almost sexually, well, he has sexually assaulted you. Where's it going? You know nothing about ballet. And I thought, they have a point. But I think I'm going to take it because, hey, what, you know, life is short. Let's have a go.
So where did you next meet up with Nureyev? Where did you see each other physically again?
Luigi had faxed his schedule. I knew he was performing in Cleveland, Ohio.
It's a long way from the Caribbean.
It's a long way from the Caribbean, which gave me an idea. Hang on, this guy's touring all the time. This is kind of hectic.
What happened when you arrived there? Did you see him dance or
yes,
what
sure.
was happening?
So I flew Auckland, Los Angeles, New York, New York, Cleveland, all in one hit, middle of December, freezing in Cleveland. And I'm 6'2", very, very tanned, blonde hair. So I stuck out in the crowd in the foyer. And he walked in the foyer for a matinee, surrounded by people, surrounded by fans. And he said, ah, there you are. Come into the dressing room. So I wandered into the dressing room and he said, are you tired? Where have you come from? New Zealand. You tired? Actually, no. Good. Undress me and make me tea. And that's how we started.
And were they going to continue as part of your key roles, undressing him and making
yes,
him tea?
Yes, I was his dresser. He was about to perform. He was about to dance. That was a matinee, and then there was an evening performance. And he needed tea, hot, sweet black tea, to fuel his body. So I always carried tea with me from that day onwards. I always carried a thermos of tea. I carried Earl Grey tea in my bag, so all my clothes smelled Earl Grey tea.
And what did undressing Nureyev involve? What does that mean?
Well, he would stand there and I'd undress him and put on his dance clothes. The only thing he'd put on was his sort of, I guess, jock strap is the athletic word. But everything else, he had a bit of arthritis in one shoulder, so I'd help him into these really tight outfits and help him put his shoes on as well. Walk to the curtain with him, walk to the stage with him. I'd have a bag of all sorts of stuff, mostly tea and mug and towels and wraps and things and beanies. And he would stand there just before he had to go on, whip off all the accessory stuff, dance and come back, and he'd want tea as soon as he got off the stage.
What an extraordinary position side stage for you. How old was Nureyev at this point?
When I first met him, I think he was 51.
And he was still dancing?
He was still dancing. The slower pieces, but the very majestic pieces. Après-midi du Faune was a beautiful piece he did. He could dance that really well. But he was also introducing younger dancers as part of his group. Mm. So he'd be on stage with them and promoting them. Yeah.
He was famous for being such an intense, passionate performer on stage. Were you nervous around him at all, frightened of him, at least in those early days and weeks of getting to know one another?
I don't think I was ever frightened of him. I don't think I was ever intimidated by him, which is a really interesting thing to say. I was confused because I didn't know dance. I didn't know the breaks. I didn't know anything about anything. And everybody around me did. You know, these beautiful, elegant, powerful ballerinas were staring at me like I was something from Mars, which I guess I was, because I had no clue what I was doing. So bumbling along just to try and make things happen. And always getting things wrong. I got things wrong every day, but you just carry on.
You'd grown up surfing and playing rugby very far away from dance. So how did ballet compare to the kind of athleticism you were more familiar with?
Well, if you get punched, and I often did, you know, tackled and hard hit or punched on a footy field, you can lie there and groan and stagger around a bit. Not in ballet. Ballet is, if anyone thinks they want a hard workout, go to a ballet class. It is incredible. And it's all day. You know, you start class in the morning, then you may have a class later on, then you perform in the evening for 3 hours. I was stunned by the physicality of it. Absolutely stunned.
One of your roles was to massage Nureyev.
Mm.
What were his muscles like at that age after those
Still
years of dance?
Incredibly phenomenal. His legs were incredibly powerful. And you can Google images of him just standing there. He started dancing at 17, which was late. And so he was ridiculed because he couldn't do the steps. And that brought a fire in him, a real temper, which also led him to ignore pretty much everybody except for himself. And he did exactly what he wanted all the time. And in the school, he was so cocky, in the ballet school in Kirov, in Leningrad, that they locked him out one night in the cold. But he overcame. That was his magical phrase, you will overcome.
Did he talk much about his childhood or growing up in the Soviet Union?
Occasionally, my job, apart from massage and driving and security and dressing, was his cook. I had to cook for him. That was in the contract. And I couldn't cook. I'm not a great cook. But he said, you must. Don't be so strict. Don't be so severe. So I had to learn to cook. And then whenever I cooked for him or his guests, so it was really good to be able to try and tease out from him his youth. His father didn't want him to become a ballet dancer. His father was a political commissar in the Soviet army. So his father beat him to try and beat some sense into him. But that just instilled Rudolf, I want to do this. I want to be a dancer and I want to be a great dancer.
What about his defection, that extraordinary decision he took at just 23 or so to leave the USSR and come to the West?
He was in Paris, and the KGB, who really ran everything, were on that tour, and they didn't like what he was doing. He was hanging out with French locals. He was going to bars and cafes too free with his mouth. Just before they were about to get on a plane to fly to the UK, to fly to London, I believe, they said, there's no room for you on this plane. You have to go back and dance at the Kremlin. And Rudolf knew that was a lie. And he immediately said, what's the performance? Where are the costumes? You know, what's the repertoire? And, of course, they had no answer for that. He said, we'll deal with it when we get there. So he knew he was in trouble. So Rudolf made absolute split decisions all his life, split-second decisions. And he said, right, I'm going to stay here. And he walked towards French officials and said, I want to stay in your country. And that, you know, eyes wide open, everybody knew there was going to be an incident. So they were shouting and screaming and pushing, and they wanted to grab him. And he was in one room while all sorts of people were on the phone trying to work out what to do with this incredibly famous Russian dancer. And the Russian interpreter was in there, and she was saying, your family will be, you know, imprisoned. And he just said, you shut up. You know, once he made a decision, that was it.
Nureyev had homes, various homes around the world, including one in New York. Where was the home in New York?
He had an apartment in the Dakota Building, which was very famous, where John Lennon lived. John and Yoko Ono lived. And he had on the second floor this huge apartment, and it overlooked Central Park. And it was full of pictures of male nudes. I mean, acres and acres, acres and acres of 18th century naked men in scabbards, you know, with scabbards and swords fighting lions or each other.
And where was your room in this apartment?
Yeah, he had an ex-boyfriend, Robert Tracy, looking after the place. Robert was injured, so he was useless. You know, if you're a dancer and you're injured, that's it, according to Rudolph. So Robert lived in a small bedroom in the back, and I shared a bedroom with him in a bed that I couldn't fit in. It was a Queen Anne bed.
So Nureyev, I'm imagining, was fabulously wealthy. What was he like with money?
He didn't understand money, and he didn't understand cash. And so which was quite rare, we went out for lunch, he had no idea how much things cost. And tipping was an absolute problem for him. He would dither, the meal would be ruined. He'd take some money out, he'd put it back, he'd ask me, how much, is that enough? Then he'd change his mind and he'd storm off from the table.
Was that because of his childhood in Russia, in the Soviet Union?
I think so. He also, every single thing, and he had houses. He had a house in Monaco, he had a house in Paris, St. Bart, in Washington, Leesburg, Virginia, a farm there. Everything that he had, he'd sweated for. So that was his currency. Physical activity, physical endurance, physical performance. And so that was going to be my currency as well.
Blue, he one day spent a lot of money, $50,000 or so, on a Greek statue. Tell me about that.
It was a Greek statue of a male nude with amazing buttocks, apparently, amazing bum. And Rudolph would lie on these long lounges overlooking Central Park on the second floor and summon myself and Robert to twist the statue so he could get good views of the buns. He said, move the buns. No, a bit more. Ah, that's it. Good. Nice. 50 grand for a pair of buns. I mean, you know, if you work for it, why not?
Russian, of course, was his first language, and I imagine he spoke French and English. What did that mean to talk with him? I mean, was he difficult to understand, or what was his language like?
You have to understand there was nothing in his life, apart from a statue with nice buttocks, there was nothing in his life but ballet. Dance was everything. When he couldn't dance, he choreographed, and he was a brilliant choreographer. And so his language came from dance. It was very shorthand. He often used his hands in a very quick maneuver, and ballerinas could understand this because they'd grown up with it. I couldn't. And so he was confused by me not understanding his shorthand. We went to Milan. We stayed in the Grand Central Milan Hotel. It was about 9:30 in the morning. We would be at work at La Scala at about 10:30. He said, run me a bath at 3:15. And I said, sure, boss. And he looked at me. And he said, well? And I said, yeah, I got it. 3:15, run. No. And he started to get angry really quickly. Fuse was lit and off he went. No, 3:15. And I said, yeah, I understand. No, now. What do you mean now? He said, turn the knobs, one at 3 and one at 15, and it'll be the right temperature, you idiot.
Oh, my goodness.
Ah, of course, obviously.
So would he lose his temper with you a lot, Blue?
Yes, a lot, all the time.
How did you handle that?
Well, a lot of it goes back to working in childcare. You learn to sort of accept some sort of people, you know, throwing the toys out the pram. A lot of it comes down to sailing offshore as well. If you experience bad weather, which we did, you learned that's, you know, just to focus and not get too upset. But he punched me once. The punch was interesting.
How did that happen?
We'd flown from Cleveland. He asked me to get a book out of his bag. I leant over and he whacked me on the backside. And I confronted about him the next morning when we got to the Dakota, and I said, you don't do that. if this is going to work, you keep your hands off me. And he couldn't believe that I was taking his time up with this nonsense. But I was standing in front of him, and I'd forgotten that, you know, when you're working in childcare, you don't block someone's exit. And he said, yes, 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 yes. And I said, no, Rudolph, if I'm going to be your assistant, you keep your hands off me. And he punched me straight away in the stomach. It was a good punch. I sort of was really winded. And I thought, okay, this is another crossroads, or this is one of the first crossroads. He went into Robert and said, Blue has no sense of humor. And Robert said, you can't do that to someone like Blue. Blue's straight. Keep your hands off him and try not to punch him too much. And Rudolph apologized. But he came back in. He said, from memory, he said, you know, I'm sorry I did that, but you must not make me do things like that.
Sort of an apology. Did you see him compromise? Did you witness that? Was that within his repertoire?
No. No, he was the maestro. He was a dancer, he was a choreographer, he then became a conductor. And maestro means master. And he had such power, Sarah. He emanated energy. He emanated power. There are people like that in the world. Most I've seen some as athletes. They have this energy fizzing out of their body. He did that all the time, so people were scared of him. We would be at La Scala. Any dance, any tour we were on, nobody would sit with us at the lunch table or the dinner table. They were too intimidated.
Was he lonely?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he tried to come into society. He tried to mix, but his temper just, he wasn't suited for it. Mm-hmm. And he called his houses, walls, lairs. And he had an island off Positano, Ligali, and he loved it. He would come into society, trip up, go back and run away.
So your role, I guess, then, was a confidant or a friend as well as a provider of all those services. Mm. It was an emotional role too.
It was, and the press were highly interested in him. There were rumours that he was unwell. There were rumours that he had HIV, maybe he had AIDS, and so the press were really aggressive, particularly in Italy and France, the paparazzi. So I became, it became part of my job to keep an eye out for paparazzis in the hotel.
What about you, Blue? Were you aware of what was going on with Nureyev's health?
From day one in Cleveland, when I, you know, undressed him and made him tea, after every performance he would go straight back to the hotel and sleep. But he slept with the heating turned right up and the windows shut, again in every apartment or place that he lived. I didn't know whether that was normal for dancers to recoup so quickly, but I could see he was getting smaller and smaller as the year progressed. And he had a doctor in France, Dr. Canese, a beautiful man, who gave me medications, AZT, to give to Rudolph. And AZT was an HIV antiretroviral, and Rudolph never took it.
He didn't take it? Why
no.
not?
He had a complex relationship with doctors and with his body. He'd broken. There's a film of him winning the Russian state dance competition as a young man, and 20 days before that, he broke his leg on stage. He was dancing, he was doing a turn, a floorboard had raised up, he caught his foot and really broke his leg. And he won that competition dancing through agony. So he fixed everything with mental resolve. And I just remembered this morning that I sat him down and said, Rudolph, the doctor said you must take these. And he said, no. And I said, but you don't understand, Rudolph. And he looked at me and said, Blue, you don't understand. I've healed everything with my mind, and I'll carry on doing that, but thanks for your help. And off we went. So I had packets of these tablets that he refused to take.
This was the early 1990s when, you know, there was still so much stigma and fear around HIV and AIDS. I mean, how familiar were you with with what HIV and what AIDS meant?
I had no idea. I was a rugby-playing heterosexual sailor. Yachtsman. I had no idea of this, but he was getting thinner and thinner and weaker, and the rumours started coming, and dancers would maybe talk behind their hands, and I, you know, told them to mind their own business. you know, we wouldn't, would you like people talking about your health and your background? And that soon shut them up.
Did he get too weak to keep dancing, to keep performing in the period you were with him?
He did. But what vitalised, what energised him was being on stage. On, people said he was dead on stage. He was dead off stage. He was driven by stage. And so there was one period we went to Milan to choreograph The Nutcracker, and it was an extraordinary performance. There were three Nutcrackers being performed in Milan, opening the same night around Christmas. So it was this real race to be the best. And he did it at La Scala. It was one of the most extraordinary moments of my life, hearing the applause for the dancers and for him. And it was beautiful. So he did that. He was a great choreographer. Herbert von Karajan and Leonard Bernstein had each individually told him to conduct. He had so much music inside him. And so he became a conductor in Vienna.
Before he got to Vienna, tell me about his rehearsals in St. Bart's. What did that look like when he was learning to be a conductor?
He would have with the Sony Walkman, I bought him a yellow Sony Walkman, and we would go to the beach and he'd be naked on the beach there. I always wore shorts, just be a bit more reserved. And he asked me to cook some soft-boiled eggs, which of course I took to the beach as a lunch, and of course they hardened in the shells, even though I put them in foil. And he was on the beach, we were surrounded by hundreds of people, and he screamed at me because he had the earphones on, so he couldn't hear himself. He said, "You didn't think they're blue, you didn't think there were enough rocks on this beach, so you brought your own." And then carried on, thump, 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 thump.
Naked with his yellow Walkman.
With a orchestral score in front of him. Beethoven, thump, 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 thump. And I said, "Oh, thanks, boss."
You know, I mean, were you able to laugh at that side to him? I mean, was that part of what let you stay there?
I think that every day I got stronger. Every day I got a little better, a little wiser. I made mistakes all the time. Every day he got weaker. So I could laugh at some of the jibes, and it was important. Humour became more and more important.
After all this rehearsal, he went to Vienna for his first gig as a conductor. Was he nervous?
He was, because he had to learn conducting, and he had been the genius of dance for so many years. He had to make mistakes, and worse than that, he made mistakes he didn't know he was making, but the orchestra did. So he got a nice, tight group of four or five individuals just in a small house just outside Vienna, just to give him the basics, to give him the confidence. And one recurring character in this is a guy called Howard Penny, Australian guy living and working in Vienna, and he was key to Rudolph's success. He was very gentle. Rudolph made a mistake the first day and stopped and froze. And if anybody had even raised an eyebrow, Rudolph would have been out the room, bags packed, gone. But Howard said, "It's okay, maestro, let's just start it again." And then Rudolph relaxed and carried on and got better and better and more confident.
And by the time it was performance night, how did it go?
It went really well. He had so much music inside him. He had so much, you know, he was infused with Tchaikovsky, infused with Mozart. You know, Beethoven he loved as well. He deeply loved Bach. He played Bach all day, every day on the piano, wherever we were. So I'd be dusting around him, you know, trying to get some of this sand off, and he wouldn't know I was there. So I'd be moving around him with a little duster, feather duster, trying to tidy up the place a bit.
One of the places the two of you spent time when he was taking a rest from conducting and other responsibilities was this little island in the Mediterranean. Tell me about what Nureyev taught you on that island.
Well, during the orchestral tours, I'd asked for a violin lesson, which nearly broke my arm, and a cello lesson from Howard, which nearly broke everyone's ears. So I thought, I'd like a dance lesson from Rudolph. And his island off Positano was owned by Massine, who was a friend of Diaghilev in Ballet Russe. So it had a dance tower on it. It was a very narrow, small island, but it had a dance tower. So I said, "Boss, can I have a lesson?" Expecting him to say, "Don't be stupid." He said, "Yes." He said, stand behind me, don't talk. Stand behind me, do what I do, if you can. It must be like Chinese to you, but have a go. And then I realised how brutally hard it is.
Did you accomplish anything? I mean, what sort of what success did you have as a ballet dancer being taught by a new age?
Limited. I mean, he taught me to dance, but not dance well. Let's put it that way. I was fascinated by the entrechamp, which is you jump and you cross your feet, and then you land again elegantly. Well, I don't. And we were walking up to do another lesson, and he said that Nijinsky used to do 10. Entrechaudis, and I couldn't believe it. And he said, yeah, I did 10, but only just the toes overlapping. Nijinsky was incredible, just the power in the legs. So I watched him do 6 or 7. I managed to do one, like an elephant. So
there must have been many moments in this relationship that you were pinching yourself blue, but being taught to do these ballet manoeuvres on an island off Positano by Nureyev must have been one of them.
And that's what kept me going. A lot of people said, how could you stand him? Well, okay. I mean, he was hard, but he was a genius, so he makes the rules. He said to me, if you're not happy, you go. And if I'm not happy with you, you're gone in a second, in a heartbeat. The same with any dancer. So it was up to me to stay.
So what finally brought your time together to an end?
I realised that he was becoming very unwell. He wasn't taking any of the medication he should have done. I was bathing him, massaging some life into him, carrying him in and out of bed. And he would wear sweatshirts to bed every night, thick double-lined sweatshirts, so he would sweat enormously in the night. I'd get up and change these for him at, 1 or 2 a.m., wringing wet, and put a new one on. And he would get up in the morning and hobble around in pain until he had hot tea, and then he'd start to go again. It was a difficult decision. We came back from Vienna once, and then we got on the boat, and he again slapped me on the backside. And I thought, hang on, is he listening to me? He keeps making the rules and breaking the rules. But also, what's next for me?
What did you want to do next?
I heard of a place called a butler school in London. Now, I had looked after Rudolf. I knew him very well, but I knew nothing about wine. I knew nothing about etiquette. I knew nothing about fabric care, security, serving dinners, food, silverware, what have you. So I put this to Rudolf, and he hated the idea. He said, you don't need that. You're very good for me. You do everything that I want you to do. I don't need any of that. And I thought, no, it's time for me to increase, perform well myself and increase my knowledge.
There was a party in Paris right near the end of your time working for Nureyev. Tell me about your entree into that event.
It was organised, I think, by Jack Lang, the Minister of Culture, and everybody was there. But it was on the top floor of one of those beautiful French apartments. There wasn't an elevator, no lift there. And we arrived there, the car dropped us off, and there was this almost spiral staircase leading up to the heavens, on the fourth floor. He couldn't walk up 2 steps, let alone there. So we managed by corralling my resources. He was smaller than me, so I turned to him, offered my left hand. He grasped my wrist like a Roman handshake. Then I reached behind him and grabbed a big chunk of his trousers and his waistband and said, are you ready? And he nodded, and I ran up those 4 flights of stairs round and round, carrying him. His feet sort of touched the ground, sort of dancing on the way up. But he used my strength to carry him up those stairs quickly. We got to the top. I had spots dancing in front of my eyes. I straightened his outfit, straightened his beret. He knocked on the door, and in he went.
When it came to say a final goodbye, what was that like? I can't quite imagine how you could predict what a goodbye with a man such as Nureyev might have been like.
Yeah. There was always the hope that I'd come back and work for him, but I wanted to study in London. And I said, he was in Vienna, and at that stage, lawyers were turning up with writs and things from ex-lovers who were now very unwell. And so Rudolf was being sued for that side of things. So I knew I was a small player, like a really tiny cog in that career. So I said, I have to go now, Rudolf. And he said, oh, good, yeah, fine. He was in bed, of course. There was less of him in bed now. He was smaller than he was a year before. And I leant over and kissed him on the mouth. And it was a sort of final farewell. And he jolted a bit and said, oh, you've never done that before? And I said, well, you know, look after yourself. And he said, oh, be well. And then I left.
Where were you, Blue, when you learned that he had died?
After Butler School, I worked in properties, and I was actually working on a super yacht, a 75-metre super yacht, 22 crew. And one of the crew burst into my cabin, and she was upset, and she said, he's dead. And I knew, of course, who it was, and then went to his funeral in Paris in that very cold January day.
What was that like?
A lot of people were there. A lot of people were really upset. I mean, he was so young. He was 54. All this energy, all this life, he was like a meteor streaking across the sky. People were fascinated by what he did and joyed by what he did. And now we were burying him. And all the ballerinas were crying, all the men were crying. And we went to the grave and lowered him in and threw his shoes in there and some white lilies. And came back.
What was going through your head and heart as you were standing there at his graveside?
Everybody was engulfed in sadness, and they all had their own private journey. I remember seeing many ballerinas who danced, performed with him, weeping and weeping, so I was probably trying to console them. I thought it was such a waste. He lived how he wanted to live. And on the van, in the bus or the coach on the way back to Paris Opera, somebody who'd worked for him said, Blue, did you always get paid? And I said, I did, always often late. He said, oh, you're the lucky one.
You'd already made this step away into a career as a butler. Tell me about Butler School. What did you learn there?
Butler School was really valuable, particularly in London, because it was on the doorstep of the big houses, you know, Gives and Hawkes, the Lobbs shoemakers. There were wine houses there. There was an enormous amount of history there. We had a lot of butlers visiting us as well. So you learnt a great deal.
It seems like that the term butler, I guess, I don't know if it's too Australian ears, it feels like something from a very different era. I mean, what's the role look like in this day and age?
The modern butler is estate management in a smart suit. Let's put it that way. You manage the estate, the property or the estate or the estates, and you oversee all facets of it. And you make sure it works, you make sure it's safe, and you make sure it's secure. So it's a position of huge responsibility and trust. And your employees, the principals, he or she or both, are often away. They're often in business or they're often travelling. So you run things as they want them to be run.
Was your year with Nureyev good training for that kind of work?
It was, because and they look at you when they, you know, when they're interviewing you, they ask, you know, your background, and they knew exactly who I was, and I seemed to, you know, reflect a level of trust, and that is why they hire you. Everything is about integrity and trust and responsibility, and they got that, and I have that, and so off we went. It was good.
I can't imagine you had many clients as memorable as Rudolf Nureyev, though. He must have been one of a kind.
He was. But he had six or seven houses on various continents, so we were always running around. He didn't give the budget to that. So when I finally got to work for other people in Europe, there was time, there was a budget. And they, you know, we had meetings and sat down and planned things, planned events, you know. So it was wonderful.
And
great
hopefully
job.
You weren't punched or prodded in the same way by your other employers.
No, I don't believe I was.
How on earth did you end up in Australia, Blue?
On that super yacht, I was working as chief steward, the 245-foot one. We were off Monaco, and I was serving dinner to the owner, Sir Donald Gosling. And a phone call came through to the radio room, and the radio officer took it and came down and said, Blue, there's a call for you. And I said, well, I'm serving the boss dinner. I can't. He said, you need to take this. So I handed the platters literally over to the steward, and it was Jane. And she'd been part of the Pacific Crossing with us. She was a girlfriend when I was 16, and she'd headed off and, you know, had a great life and come to Sydney. And we chatted, and I said, "Look, I've got a bit on here, but let's, you know, hurry it up if you can." She said, "I think I married the wrong guy. I'm a bloke. I'm a bit thick." And I said, "What's that got to do with me?" Well. And she said, no, we should probably. So that was a huge bombshell. And I resigned from that position. And the captain was really upset. He thought I was going to another yacht. He had a great team. And I said, no, I'm going to get married.
So what, out of that call from a girlfriend you had at 16?
Yeah. I really thought a great deal about this woman a lot of the time. But she was off having a great life. She'd met a guy. Good luck to her and all that. But it seemed that, you know, things were going to change.
Do you think your time with Nureyev, you know, I don't know, encouraged you to be able to make split decisions, follow your heart like that?
Maybe it did. Maybe that's the payment that I got. the heart is everything, Sarah. Make mistakes. If you want to do something, do it. A lot of people tell you not to do it. That was the whole Rudolph thing. They were scared about what might happen. Well, go and have a try. Make an effort. And make mistakes as well. And you can always stop and say, okay, that was a huge error, and go backwards.
So where's home for you these days, Blue?
We live in Killala Bay, in Jervis Bay, which is south of Sydney. And I realise it's very much like Jersey, where I grew up. There's surf there. You can paddleboard there. I sail a lot down there. And it's a beautiful part of Australia.
Do you still ever do any of those dance steps that Nureyev taught you?
I didn't this morning. I did a little bit of stretching, but not that one. I think maybe I should. Maybe I could revisit it. How about that?
Blue, what a wonderful story. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
It's been a wonderful pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
Simon Blue Robinson was my guest on Conversations today. This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Eliza Kirsch. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.